Right. So what on earth, what in heaven is that all about? We have a fascination with the end of the world. I mean, I like going to the movies and I like going to these huge Hollywood blockbusters, you know, that describe what will happen at the end times as much as anybody else. And so the fact that 2012 has just come out this week, I will be lining up sometime this week, hopefully, to see yet another of the series of end of the world kind of things, like Independence Day and The Day After Tomorrow, and earlier this year there was Knowing, and there's been the whole series of these. Go into a bookshop and you see, you know, at least, you know, a shelf full of books talking about the end of the world. Prophecies from the Mayan Empire or from Nostradamus or whatever. And we in the Christian church are not immune to this. And we've got the ammunition. We've got in the Old Testament the book of Daniel. We've got passages like this from the whole of chapter 13 of Mark's Gospel. And of course, Scripture finishes with that impenetrable book, the book that we call the book of Revelation or the book of Apocalypse. First, to understand the word. When we talk about the apocalypse or apocalyptic literature, it's not primarily about the end of the world. We tend to imagine that that's what it's about. But the word itself, apocalypse, comes from the Greek, apokalypto. Kalypto is a veil. Apo means you're removing the veil. So it's this sense of looking through to see what is the reality of the situation. And the same with revelation, coming from the Latin word, revelatio. The same sense of revealing the truth. Apocalyptic literature is usually written in a time when there's great persecution. So the book of Daniel was written during the Jews' exile in Babylon, a time when the kingdom of Babylon was deeply persecuting the Jewish people. And so you couldn't write things simply and clearly. You wrote things in a kind of code in order that those who had an inside knowledge would understand and would receive encouragement. The same with the book of Revelation, written at the end of the first century during a time of deep persecution of the Christian church by the Roman Empire. That's the first thing. The second is that to understand this particular passage in Mark's Gospel, we need to, of course, read the whole of the chapter. And Mark 13 begins with Jesus and the disciples sitting in the temple forecourt. It takes place during Holy Week. So Jesus and the disciples have arrived at the beginning of the previous chapter on Palm Sunday. And so this is in the middle of Holy Week, just a couple of days until the great events of the passion and death of Jesus are about to take place. Jesus knows that this is what is about to unfold. And so he's there preparing his disciples, giving them courage, giving them that sense of something tremendous, something apocalyptic is about to happen. And so they're there as country bumpkins. You know, most of the disciples are from Galilee, up in the deep country. It's about as redneck as, I don't know, sassafras or something. The sense of way up out in the sticks. Maybe it's, you know, place where I came from Brogo. That kind of territory. And so you know, like I know that as a country kid. I remember the first time when I went overseas. And as a good Catholic boy, the first place we went was, of course, Rome. And getting off the train at St. Peter's Station and walking around and just seeing this incredible church, that's what it would have been like for these disciples seeing the temple. The temple as it was rebuilt by King Herod was absolutely amazing, absolutely impressive. Its western wall was 485 meters long. Nearly half a kilometer. St. Peter's on the other end is only 220 meters long. I mean, St. Peter's is incredible, huge, massive. Who's been there? Okay, you know what I'm talking about. You know that when you walk in, you're just blown away by the size and the scope. St. Peter's will seat 60,000 people. This church seats about 300. So it's just a little bit bigger than St. Michael's in Nara. But the temple was even bigger than St. Peter's. I mean, maybe the temple, the whole complex, would have fit in the space of St. Peter's Church and the square in the front. But that kind of sense, you know, it would fit several hundred thousand people. And it was adorned with limestone and marble and gold. It was just magnificent. You know, the largest building for hundreds of miles in any direction. People would make a journey of a lifetime to go to Jerusalem to see this temple. And so as it begins, as this chapter begins, the disciples are just pointing to it going, Master, that is just amazing. That is so beautiful. And Jesus responds by saying, but I tell you the truth, not one single stone will be left standing on another. Jesus knows the tension that's happening politically between the Jewish people and the Roman Empire. That there are these zealots who are present within the Jewish enterprise. These people who are urging revolution. These people who are trying to build up the courage to, you know, mount an arms insurrection against the empire. He knows that war is looming. And so he's able to predict with, you know, absolute certainty that this is one of the consequences. That it's the temple has represented everything about the Jewish faith. Not just religiously, but culturally, politically, socially. It's the heart of everything that the Jewish people and the Jewish race is about. And so he predicts its destruction. And we know historically that it's only another 40 years until all of that takes place in the year 70 AD. And so he is able to point to this as one of those changes. But he doesn't leave it at the temple. If the temple is the very center of their life, so as they look around, they realize that everything that they know in the world is coming to an end. And so he points to the sun and the moon and the stars. Now, if I want to know what time it is, what do? I look at my watch. And I'm sure none of you would be even thinking about doing that right now. But you would look at your watch. But in the ancient world, you looked at the sun. You worked out its position in the sky. And you knew from that what time of day it was. If you're trying to navigate, when I get lost, I pull out my mobile phone and turn on the GPS. And that helps me to know where I am. But in the ancient world, you looked at the position of the stars at night. You were able to tell the seasons from looking out. You had light from the sun, from the moon. We just flick a switch. So the world is different. But for them, the whole sense of where the world was, how you understood things, how you knew where you were going, was about the sun, the moon, and the stars. So Jesus is telling them that something tremendous is about to take place. Something incredible that's going to happen not at the end of the world, not at the end of the space-time continuum, but in this generation. If we take this language literally, if we misunderstand what apocalyptic is about, if we pretend, like certain people that used to live over the north side of the river, that the world was going to come to an end, that you could read in Scripture all of these prophecies and the fulfillment of these, the tidal waves were going to come and hit Perth, that all of these things would be revealed. We miss the point entirely. This is not language about the end of the world. This is language about the end of the world at the moment. The end of the world that's dominated by death. If the whole way that we understand the world is determined by the position of the sun and the moon and the stars, so the way that we live our lives is determined by that fear of death, by the fact that, like taxes, death hangs over us, that death is there dominant, that empires and governments and rulers are able to hold that fear of death over us, that if we want to rise up, that they will say, no, we will crush you. Jesus knows that if you cross the Roman Empire will respond with the cross. He knows the power of death over us. He knows that so much of our sin, so much of what we do, is as a result of this sense of death. That we try and beat death with technology. We try and beat death by making ourselves look beautiful. We try and beat death by going on an exercise routine. We try and defeat death by buying new clothes. We try and defeat death through sex, through a pursuit of money, through a pursuit of power. We imagine that all these things will prevent death from finally getting us. But they don't. And so our sin, all of our dysfunction, all of the way that we get caught up in ourselves is a result of this empire. And he knows that the world is dominated by death. Just as everything in our life at that point was dominated by looking at the sun and the moon and the stars. And so, pointing to their defeat, their destruction, the fact that the sun will grow dim, that the stars will fall out of the sky, was saying that what is about to happen in this generation, while you're all able to witness it, is going to be the end of that era. When Jesus went to the cross, when Jesus stretched out his arms on that cross, when he allowed the powers of death and sin and destruction to be taken on board into his flesh, when he defeated all that, when he surrendered fully and completely to the will of God, when on the third day, God raised him from the dead. Death was defeated. The whole kingdom and empire of death was destroyed. But of course, we still live in a world dominated more by Bad Friday than by Easter Sunday. We still live in a world that empires and kings and sovereigns imagine that they can defeat freedom by that fear of death. We still live in a world where marketers continue to sell us with this idea that the only way to defeat death is by buying their product. We need to allow this truth of God's defeat of death through new life on Easter Sunday to be part of our world, to be at the very center of who we are. That is why the language of apocalyptic is always good news. It always offers such tremendous hope to a people that are oppressed, to a people that know that they are under the power of death, that this gives us an incredible insight into God's victory, God's ultimate victory over everything that works against the kingdom of life. As a people, as a Christian people, it's appropriate that we always end our liturgical year with these readings that remind us of our victory over death and sin. That it's only in the power of Jesus that that happens. But it's not something that just happened once. It has to continue to happen. We have to continue to open ourselves to this victory. We have to allow that grace and that gift to be part of our life so that we, in our place, can be the people of Revelation, that we can be the people that take this on board and share it with a world desperate to know that victory over sin and death, won through the resurrection of Jesus.
Behold, he's coming with the clouds, setting all the captives free. Those who long to see this day will tremble with delight. As a sea of upturned faces, there is bathed in air.